for injuries. She came to the job agnostic on the then-increasing use of opiates in medicine. In the hospitals where she worked up to then, opiates were used for broken legs or following surgery, which she believed appropriate. Mai possessed an intense need for order. Sloppiness and unanswered questions were anathema. She cleaned her house a lot because it helped her de-stress and think things through while restoring order. She loved to garden, as much to instill order as for the love of plants. She prized roses and planted them outside the new house that she and her husband bought when she was hired on as LNI's chief pharmacist. She would need them. One part of her job involved ensuring doctors were documenting whether the new opiate painkillers were helping to reduce patients' pain and improve their ability to function. Otherwise, why should the state keep paying for the drugs? There, she saw for the first time how the drugs were used for chronic pain and grew alarmed. It was automatic. "You hurt? Let me write you a prescription for opioids," she said. They were treating patients with opioids, and the patient would come in with more complaints of pain a month later, and they would up the dose. "See me next month." I could see in the medical record that the provider wasn't checking to see if the drug was even helping them. The patient would come in every visit complaining of more pain. Nobody ever said, "Wait a minute, time out, let's figure out what's going on." 50, 100 cases a month. But there's no attempt to document if the drug was working, one, or, two, if they even are appropriate candidates to receive opioids. Did they try a non-opioid first? Then, 6 months into the job, Mai noticed some of these workers began dying from these very painkillers. This didn't happen. Workers whose original complaint was a sprained back or knee did not die. Yet one case after another crossed her desk, all overdosing. In Washington, in a typical year, 50 or more workers died, but these were from accidents, electrocutions, falls, etc., or from cancers like asbestosis. Now, workers with back sprains were dying as well. She went to her boss, LNI's medical director, Dr. Gary Franklin. "What should we be doing about them?" Gary Franklin had been an opiate skeptic from the start. He had a master's degree in public health and several years as a professor of neurology and preventive medicine at the University of Colorado. He took the job as LNI's medical director in 1988, as the crusade to destigmatize opiates in medicine was getting underway. Soon, doctors advising LNI were quoting Porter and Jick on the percentage of pain patients addicted when prescribed opiates. "Not more than 1%, they'd say. We don't think they're addictive as we used to think," Franklin said. In 1999, Washington, through a state medical commission, removed legal sanctions for doctors for prescribing narcotics in the course of acceptable medical practice, its own intractable pain regulation. It meant there's no ceiling on dose, that the way to treat tolerance is to increase the dose, Franklin said. Now, 2 years into these state regulations allowing more liberal prescribing, his new chief pharmacist was in his office telling him she was seeing opiate overdose deaths of workers with bad backs. Franklin still had questions. Were these workers dying from recreational abuse of opiates or pills they'd been prescribed? "We didn't want to overcall the deaths," Franklin told me. "Doctors had spent so much time getting people to use more opioids. I knew we were going to take a hit if we said people are dying of prescription opioids." More information was needed. Death certificates, coroner autopsy reports, the drug prescription for each person who died. Over the next 2 years, in a back room on LNI's second floor, Mai pored over cases of workers dying from opiate overdoses. Finding them was the first task. Some 266 people in the workers' comp system had died since 1995. Mai whittled this down to 60 where drugs were mentioned, and ordered the doctor's records, the death certificate, and the autopsy reports for each. Finally, in 2005, in a paper published in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, Franklin and Mai reported that 44 people with chronic pain in Washington's workers' comp system had died due definitely, probably, or possibly to prescription opiate use between 1995 and 2002. Most had died after 1999, the year the state's intractable pain regulation was written. Most were men. Most were under 50 years old. They had come to workers' comp with non-life-threatening ailments, lower back pain or carpal tunnel syndrome, say, for which they were prescribed Schedule II opiates, and were dead a short while later. Mai and Franklin also found that prescriptions for the strongest opiates more than doubled. Prescriptions for much milder pain relievers dropped or remained the same. This was also strange. Normally, doctors would be expected to start out with the milder drugs, but faced with patient pain, doctors were going right to the heavy artillery, and that meant, beginning in about 1997, OxyContin. Franklin and Mai's paper was the first time anyone in the country had documented the deaths associated with the new prescribing of opiates for non-cancer pain. They wrote to workers' comp doctors, telling them this was happening. They got phone calls in return from people outraged that the state might be preparing to take away their meds. But then directors from Washington's Medicaid and the Veterans Administration got on the phone. They were also finding opiate overdose deaths on the rise. Mai and Franklin called Jennifer Sable. Sable is an epidemiologist at the state of Washington's Department of Health and had just begun studying deaths from injury and violence, including fatal drug overdoses. Mai and Franklin asked whether the surge in opiate overdose deaths was taking place not only among Washington workers, but across the state's population. Sable said she'd look. Junkie Kingdom in Dreamland, Portsmouth, Ohio. Finally, inevitably, Dreamland closed. This happened in 1993. Jamie Williams had sold it years before. The new owners couldn't keep up the pool, and the population was no longer there to support it. More people had pools in their backyards. Dreamland stood empty for 2 years. Residents organized to save it, but there were fewer of them now since Portsmouth had lost its steel mill and shoe factories. The city could have bought it, but dallied. The owners made a deal with a developer who wanted to put in a shopping center. Dreaming of tax revenue as budget shrank, the city council let it happen. Before anyone could sue to stall the deal, the developer brought in bulldozers late at night and crippled the pool by knocking out its filtration system. Over 2 months, the bulldozers tore out the lockers and the diving boards, filled in Dreamland and covered it in blacktop. Long-time Portsmouthians couldn't bear to watch. In O'Reilly Auto Parts and an AT&T cellular store now stand at the edge of a massive asphalt parking lot that was once Dreamland. Tax revenue from Dreamland never much materialized. Instead, the Dreamland debacle fed the idea that City Hall contained a bunch of dullards. As the town's decline intensified, Portsmouth opted for a strong mayor, a form of government usually reserved for large cities. It would save the town the cost of a city manager. But the mayors had no experience in, or time for, running a town's complicated daily affairs. One mayor was a grocery store clerk. Predictably, basic municipal governance was abandoned. Trash pickup schedules grew undecipherable. Unlit parks became prostitution hives. Police, with few officers, gave up. City politics became a street brawl and recalls grew common. City council meetings were left to gadflies infected with a debilitating negativity. Nothing could work, so why try? For years, the town had a protector in Vern Riff Jr. Riff ran a political machine from his post as the powerful Democratic Speaker of Ohio's House of Representatives. A son of Portsmouth, he was a prolific fundraiser. He funneled tax money into the town and other forgotten parts of Appalachian Ohio. He had Shawnee State University built in Portsmouth. As Portsmouth benefactor, Riff was a beloved figure. Yet he was part of a larger culture of dependence that Portsmouth had trouble shaking. "Everybody was looking for some outside source to come in and save us," said Scott Duthit, a native son and professor of sociology at the university. After Dreamland closed, the town went indoors. Police took the place of the communal adult supervision that the pool had provided. Walmart became the spot to socialize. opiates, the most private and selfish of drugs, moved in, and made easy work of a landscape stripped of any communal girding. Kids used to get together for beers and bonfires by the river and talk all night. Bonfires seemed to fade away once the pills came around. The factories and the shops on Chillicothe Street were replaced by the clinics David Proctor pioneered, which found cheap space in the town's abandoned buildings. Pill mills were about the only locally owned businesses to open. By the new millennium, Purdue Pharma's promotion of OxyContin and the crusade to liberalize opiate prescribing were seeing their first noxious efforts across southern Ohio, West Virginia, and eastern Kentucky. Portsmouth, for a while, had a pill mill for every 1,800 residents. "My daughter was addicted," said Lisa Roberts, the city's public health nurse. "A judge's kid became addicted. A mayor's kid became addicted. A police chief's kid got addicted. The kids who came from excellent families got addicted." It seemed like an evil lottery, a massive brainwashing. One by one, people succumbed. After a while, Roberts could recognize the look, say, in an old friend she hadn't seen for a while. "They're coming over to your house with these big, elaborate stories to get money off you," she said. "It's like watching people being picked off one by one by one." Slaves to the morphine molecule, the generation born to the town's decline set about tearing Portsmouth apart. You could see them trudging like zombies along Highway 52, which ran through Portsmouth, on missions to placate the molecule. They ripped air conditioners out of houses for the copper wire inside. They stole manhole covers. They took large spools of copper wire from behind the school district office. They stole their children's Christmas presents. Until finally, alone down on the Ohio River, Portsmouth became a kind of junkie kingdom, and pills became currency, more valuable than cash, to a degree unlike any other town in America. A raging, full-blown OxyContin economy developed. DVDs, refrigerators, dentist visits, cable TV installation, Tide detergent, tools, clothes, and children's school supplies. Pills bought them all in Portsmouth, Ohio. Among the first local entrepreneurs to emerge was Mary Ann Henson, a pretty blonde woman who grew up middle class. Her adoptive parents cherished her and were very religious. She didn't recall so much as a beer in her refrigerator growing up. She was a cheerleader at East Portsmouth High School, and in the fall of 1990, she was the school's homecoming queen. It was a bittersweet moment, as nobody knew she was 2 months pregnant. She started using pills not long after leaving home with her newborn daughter at the end of her senior year. "I thought I knew everything," she said. "I was 18. Marianne ended up strung out, on welfare, with food stamps and a Medicaid health insurance card. For a while, she had a boyfriend who broke into pharmacies with a group of friends. Her boyfriend went to prison, and Marianne was strapped for cash. One day, a friend asked, "Hun, ain't you been to the doctor?" The woman took her to a doctor named John Lilly. Lilly had followed David Proctor's lead and opened the area's second pain clinic. Lilly was in downtown Portsmouth. His clinic line stretched around the block. Lilly asked Marianne to lift one knee, then the other, and the visit was over. He prescribed her a month's worth of Lorset and Xanax. Marianne gave half the pills to the woman who paid for her visit and kept half. The woman then took her across the river to David Proctor for the same charade. Marianne sold her pills, and a business was formed. She began going to Lilly and Proctor. Pill abuse was a minor subculture back then. Abusing Vicodin or Lortab was hard work. They contained only small doses of opiates and included acetaminophen or Tylenol to discourage their abuse. People who used them usually developed serious liver problems from the acetaminophen, but they didn't often overdose on the weaker pills. Once OxyContin arrived, however, it went from people strung out on dope to people strung out and dying on dope, said one Portsmouth addict who by then was taking so many Lortabs that he permanently damaged his liver. In Portsmouth, OxyContin did something else. It turned pill scamming into big business for the town's generation of decline. Marianne bought the MRI results of a person with a sprained lumbar. She scanned the pages into a computer and used the MRI repeatedly, changing the name on it over and over. Next, she recruited street addicts. She paid them to go to the doctor, each armed with that MRI in their names. The docs of Portsmouth charged $250 cash per visit. In time, Marianne was driving several addicts at a time to one clinic one day, another group of addicts to another clinic the next, waiting while they got their prescriptions. Usually, each addict left the clinic with scripts for 90-80 milligram OxyContins, three a day for a month. The doctor also prescribed 120 generic oxycodone 30 milligram pills and 90 Xanax bars. Marianne took half of the haul in exchange for driving the addict to the clinic and paying the $250 doctor's fee. This became a classic business model in Portsmouth and elsewhere. Thousands of people procured dope and made money this way. The weak link in this pill scam was pharmacists. Many local Portsmouth pharmacists soon caught on and wouldn't fill prescriptions from notorious clinics. So addicts crowded into cars, driven by dealers like Marianne, and set off rummaging through rural towns for hours, looking for willing pharmacists. The whole time they talked about dope like gold miners, about all they're going to do with their pills this time. This time, they vowed, they weren't going to use them. Rather, they were going to sell them and accumulate some cash. Then they would be the ones to drive junkies to clinics and pay their visits. Those dreams evaporated on the long ride home as they snorted or injected their pills and were left again with nothing. Once a pharmacist was found, another problem presented itself: how to pay for the prescription. The price of each patient's prescribed drugs was between $800 and $1,200. Paying cash was certainly an option. But for junkies, and even for dealers with more discipline, coming up with that kind of money was hard. And so the Medicaid card entered our story. The card provides health insurance through Medicaid, and part of that insurance pays for medicine, whatever pills a doctor deems that the insured patient needs. Among those who receive Medicaid cards are people on state welfare or on a federal disability program known as SSI, Supplemental Security Income. In Scioto County, annual SSI applicants almost doubled in the decade ending 2008, from 870 to 1,600. An untrained observer of Portsmouth's bleak economic landscape might have understood. Jobs, after all, were scarce. People needed money, and that check helped. That was true. But by then, pills and pain clinics had altered the classic welfare calculus. It wasn't the monthly SSI check people cared so much about. Rather, they wanted the Medicaid card that came with it. If you could get a prescription from a willing doctor, and Portsmouth had plenty of those, the Medicaid health insurance cards paid for that prescription every month. For a $3 Medicaid copay, therefore, an addict got pills priced at $1,000, with the difference paid for by U.S. and state taxpayers. A user could turn around and sell those pills, obtained for that $3 copay, for as much as $10,000 on the street. Combined with pill mills, the Medicaid card scam allowed prolific quantities of prescription medication to hit the streets. The more pills that sloshed around the region, the more people grew addicted, and the bigger the business grew, and the more people died. The Oxy black market might never have spread and deepened so quickly had addicts been forced to pay for all those pills with cash at market prices. More isolated parts of Appalachia had other stories to tell about OxyContin, stories not connected to pill mills, but just as related to economic decline, and thus to SSI and Medicaid cards. In hilly Floyd County, Kentucky, 100 miles south of Portsmouth, the story had to do with mining. When the deep mines were working years ago, Floyd County had a lot of jobs. A man would work down in the mines for 20 years, pay into his disability, a federal program known as Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, and be out of the mines with black lung by age 45, with a monthly check large enough to support a family. That became a life strategy in eastern Kentucky. But when the deep mines closed, strip mines took their place, using far fewer workers. Those who worked weren't so easily injured. They didn't qualify for workers' compensation. As jobs disappeared, so did the disability income people could receive. Eventually, entire families grew up on SSI, which paid only a few hundred dollars a month. SSI, however, did come with a Medicaid card, and that made all the difference when OxyContin appeared. 20 years ago, they were drawing SSDI and full workers' comp, say $1,800 a month, said Brent Turner, the Commonwealth prosecutor for that part of eastern Kentucky, whose career began in 2000, just as OxyContin became a business for impoverished families across Appalachia. The checks were higher because they'd go to work in the mines and pay into their SSDI disability. Now we've got people who aren't working, who are drawing SSI maybe $500 a month. We've got people who have kids and wives and the whole family trying to survive on $500. I'm not making excuses for them. Many haven't had a job, but it is what it is. When you don't work, and you never have had a job or paid into the system, you don't qualify for much. We have boatloads of people who qualify only for SSI. You wouldn't believe the number of people we see, 20 or 30 years old, have never had a job and are drawing checks since they were teenagers. That was one of the driving factors when pills exploded. We can talk morality all day long, but if you're drawing $500 a month and you have a Medicaid card that allows you to get a monthly supply of pills worth several thousand dollars, you're going to sell your pills. As the pain revolution took hold, decent family docs were real liberal about prescribing them, Turner said. You have the easy availability of all these narcotics, and you put it all together, and they just exploded. When it comes to pills, it's the aggregation of all those small-time people is what's killing everybody. If the only people we incarcerate are Scarface, we won't incarcerate anybody. It's a cultural thing, and everybody's doing it. Much like the Jalisco heroin system, OxyContin didn't have kingpins. Instead, the market was moved by a bunch of small-time operators, relying on newly relaxed attitudes regarding pain pill prescribing, a new pill with a huge whack of dope, and the Medicaid card. Medicaid cards had been around for years. With OxyContin, they became licenses to print money. We always assume that Purdue Pharma knew that so many people in the area had Medicaid cards, Lisa Roberts, the Portsmouth City nurse, told me. And that's why they marketed OxyContin so hard around here. Whether the company knew that, Purdue did have information on the doctors who prescribed drugs most liberally. Many of them were in areas, not coincidentally, where the numbers of welfare and federal disability recipients were comparatively high, like southern Ohio and eastern Kentucky. Every pill Mary Ann Henson harvested from the addicts whom she took to a pain clinic, she could sell for $1 a milligram. $80 for one Oxy 80 milligram pill, in other words. At those prices, and taking half the pills from each addict, she could make $5,000 from each patient she took to a doctor. She sold the pills from her house with her husband, Keith Henson. Years later, they remembered their operation resembling a McDonald's drive-thru. 4 people on the porch waiting, while 10 more were doing business in the living room. Portsmouth once had the industrial ingenuity to invent the shoelace machine. Now, it invented the modern pill mill. The clinics and OxyContin made Portsmouth, Ohio a destination again. People flocked to the pain clinics from southern Ohio, eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, and Indiana. People in line to see John Lilly ordered pizza while they waited. They drank beer and snorted pills and puked in the bushes. Fortune Williams, out in Kentucky, hired security guards to direct traffic. From her flooring shop next to David Proctor's clinic, Karen Charles watched fistfights among patients in line. Those lines were the addict internet. News spread along the line about what doctor prescribed which drugs, who had a car stereo for sale. It may have been in those clinic lines where OxyContin first emerged as an economic currency in Portsmouth, Ohio. Addicts of the morphine molecule valued dope above everything, including children and cash. Pills could not be altered or diluted. Pills held their value and that value was printed on each pill. It helped that OxyContin came in 40 and 80 milligram pills, and generic oxycodone came in 10, 15, 20, and 30 milligram doses, different denominations for ease of use as currency. The pill mills acted as the central banks, controlling the money supply, which they kept constant and plentiful, and thus resisted inflationary or deflationary spikes. By the late 1990s, a critical mass was achieved, and for about a decade, the value of most goods in Portsmouth and many services was measured in pills. Armed robbers in Portsmouth hit dealers' houses, took the pills, and ignored the cash. Marianne once bought a car with OxyContin. She paid an off-duty cable TV worker in pills to install service. She paid a dentist visit with pills. She ransomed Keith from drug-addicted kidnappers with pills. She bought steak and diapers and laundry detergent with pills. Shoes for pills. Purses for pills. Perfume for pills. Crucially, pills also bought children's love. Junkies, whose main relationship was with dope, could briefly emerge from the fog to buy their children the toy, video game, or bracelet they coveted with pills, usually buying it off a shoplifter. Part of the economy was a pulsing network of people putting out feelers, kind of a junkie Craigslist. Someone says, "Hey, I'm looking for a chainsaw," Marianne said. Then some guy comes by with a chainsaw. You buy the chainsaw for an oxycodone 30 you paid almost nothing for, thanks to your Medicaid card. And you call the other guy and sell him the chainsaw for $100 cash. Something like that had evolved with Lorset years before, but on a tiny scale. OxyContin, with so much dope in each pill, bought big stuff. Stone-cold, teeth-gnashing, mainlining junkies like Marianne now had big-screen TVs and computers, nice furniture and power tools. Even urine leaked into the OxyContin economy. As authorities scrutinized Scioto County doctors, some clinics began requiring occasional urine tests. Probation officers always wanted them. So a black market in clean urine emerged, in which the fluid was exchanged like water in the desert. Addicts bought false bladders they strapped to their stomachs, with tubes leading down into their pants. Neighbors of one pain clinic near downtown got used to people knocking on their doors asking if they wanted to sell their urine. Outside the pill mill stood people who charged in pills to pee in a cup, promising clean urine as they chugged water. Veteran clients would crumble oxycodone into the purchased urine, because doctors wanted to see that patients had no drug in their system other than what they prescribed. Kids' urine was coveted for its purity, and was worth an Oxy 40 in Portsmouth for several years. Meanwhile, a sophisticated opiate class system emerged. At the top were the people who never used, but sold pills and bought anything a junkie brought in. The late Jerry Lockhart was one of the elite. He lived on a promontory dubbed OxyContin Hill in West Portsmouth. Lockhart also took people monthly to see pill mill doctors, paid for their visits, and then took half the pills they were prescribed. These people were street rats, the lowest of the opiate class system. Street rats were addicts who could never accumulate the capital to pay for their own doctor's visit, much less anyone else's. They scavenged scrap metal or stole lawn ornaments from front yards. They had a million hustles to get well through the month. The town had hundreds of street rats, and more crowding in from elsewhere on day trips to Portsmouth pill mills. The relationship between street rats and distributors like Lockhart resembled sharecropping. One way street rats made it through the month was to ask dealers like Jerry Lockhart to front them pills. By the time their monthly doctor's appointment rolled around, they owed most of what they were going to be prescribed. "If we were getting 180 of them, we already owed him 100, another addict said. I talked to an addict named Donnie. In the Marines overseas, Donnie had been badly wounded, for which he was given morphine. He carried the taste of opiates with him when he returned to Portsmouth, which by then was bathing in them. As an oxy addiction took hold, Donnie began selling his garage tools. He figured he sold almost all those tools to Jerry Lockhart. During the month, he went frequently to Lockhart for pills. Lockhart would give him 2, expecting 4, after the doctor's visit. By his doctor's visit, Donnie usually owed Lockhart almost all of what he was going to be prescribed. Lockhart traded pills for stolen goods, which he sold out of a large garage on his property. He gave addicts pills for their food stamp cards and bought groceries with the cards. One addict said he gave Lockhart his card and didn't see it again until Lockhart died 2 years later. An addict who said he worked for Lockhart told me Lockhart built virtually his entire house with material purchased with Lowe's gift cards. All these cards came via merchandise addicts stole from the store. They returned the shoplifted stuff for gift cards. Then they brought the cards to Lockhart for pills. Shoplifters, in fact, were the wandering peddlers in Portsmouth's junkie kingdom, providing the goods central to daily life in the OxyContin economy and taking only pills in payment. They stole groceries or tampons or detergent or microwaves on order. Shoplifters' importance to the OxyContin economy grew, in turn, from a new and indispensable rural institution. In Portsmouth, as in much of rural America, most of what there is to buy is sold only at Walmart. In this case, the Walmart is in the neighboring town of New Boston, on the land where the coke plant once stood, and the smokestack remains. Everybody shops and socializes there. I live in Southern California, a market that Walmart has not penetrated as completely. When I lived in Mexico, the Walmarts were only in Mexico City's far-off suburbs. I entered my first Walmart in 2003 while visiting a southwest Kansas meatpacking town for a story about a high school soccer team. I came with a set of embarrassingly naive images of what I expected from southwest Kansas. Few areas had contributed so many icons to Americans' history: pioneers, cattle trails, family farms, Dodge City, and even the Wizard of Oz. All of it pivoted around, I imagined, the main street of small-town America. I instead found ghost towns. My footsteps echoed down small-town main streets. On one, a pharmacist left a note in the window of her store. She had enjoyed serving the town, she wrote, but couldn't hang on anymore, and she hoped they'd understand why she was leaving like all the rest. She left no forwarding address. Walmart was often the only place to buy most of life's essentials in these heartland towns. Strolling their Walmarts, I imagine its aisles haunted by the ghosts of store owners who once sustained small-town America. On one aisle was the departed local grocer, down another the former hardware store owner, next to that the woman's clothier or that long-gone pharmacist. So maybe I should not have been surprised to learn that in Portsmouth's OxyContin economy, when the new rural junkies needed to get well, like everybody else, they turned to Walmart. Before OxyContin, it wasn't much to scrounge up $4 or $5 to buy a Lorset or a Vicodin to get well. You could find that in your couch, said one addict. Then Oxy came around, with its large dose of dope, high cost, and much stronger withdrawals. Suddenly, dope-sick junkies needed a place where they could quickly come up with $200 in merchandise to sell. The more money you need to get the pill, the more products got to be had, said Keith Henson, Marianne's husband. You could go to Walmart and spend a half hour in there and get enough for a pill or two. Of course, users could also con loved ones. They sold dope themselves. They broke into gun shops or robbed drug dealers. Lashed on by the morphine molecule, they did that and a lot more. But for many, the enormous blue retailer drew them like a magnet. Barred from your local Walmart, another was 25 miles away in almost any direction. Some large, though immeasurable, amount of the merchandise supporting addiction, as the opiates settled on Heartland America, was mined from the aisles of Walmart, where main streets had gone to die. In Portsmouth's Oxy economy, junkie shoplifters had to be flexible. On any given day, they might get orders for boys' shoes and a power saw and car stereo speakers and a T-bone steak. Once upon a time, that might have meant visits to 4 shops on Chillicothe Street. No longer. Walmart has such a big variety, said Angie Thuma, a former nurse who stole from Walmart for years as a street addict. I had people I would sell shoplifted items to on a daily basis. Everything was in one spot. If you need men's clothes, it was at Walmart. If you needed shoes, I stole hundreds of pairs of shoes from Walmart. It was everything a person would want in one store. Walmart also regulated prices in the OxyContin economy. Shoplifters got half the value in pills of the price tag on the item. If there was no price lifted on, say, a Black & Decker circular saw an addict was offering, Keith Henson said, you'd call Walmart and do a price check. I'm looking for this Black & Decker circular saw. How much do them run? They'd tell you. It's $69.99. Keith would pay roughly half that in pills, usually an oxycodone 30, for that circular saw the addict was offering. Of course, prices were subject to a junkie's desperation. This was pitiless commerce. Marianne once offered a junkie an oxycodone 15 for a pair of stolen Nike Jordan basketball shoes because the guy was too dope sick to go find another buyer. She bought a refrigerator from a family with children for $3.30s. But generally, if a shoplifter stole a bag of diapers, Tide detergent, DVDs, and a power sander worth about $200 at Walmart, he had a reasonable expectation that a dealer in town would pay him half the value in pills, an OxyContin 80 and an oxycodone 20. It helped that Walmart employees displayed little love for the store and its famously low wages. Some workers were strung out themselves. Some greeters were too old to recognize what was happening. Either way, a lot of Walmart workers had no hankering for a junky face-off. They're making $10 an hour, said a veteran booster I met in Portsmouth. They can see the look in our faces. Don't get in our way. Every now and then you find one with a cape, one who's trying to get that manager position. The tough guy is going to try. But when I'm in withdrawal, I'm tougher. The opiate scourge might never have spread as quickly had these rural areas where it all started possessed a diversity of small retailers, whose owners had invested their lives in their stores, knew the addicts personally, and stood ready to defend against them. Walmart allowed junkie shoplifters to play Santa to the pill economy, filling dealers' orders for toys and presents in exchange for dope. Angie Thuma supplied a half dozen dealers with all their Christmas presents for several years running, and gifts for her kids as well. As it happened, Christmas Day was big for dealers, who opened for business awaiting junkies wanting to exchange for pills the gifts they, or their children, received. For a couple months before each Christmas, I couldn't steal enough, Thuma said. Even if I went several times a day, I didn't have enough arms to get everything they wanted. It was not only drug dealers who bought the lifted merchandise. Many in the town's depressed minimum-wage economy were avid for a deal and didn't care too much where it came from. Some of Angie Thuma's best clients were middle-aged women raising their grandkids who couldn't get by on the salaries they earned. But by and large, it was dealers who fueled the shoplifting trade and prodded the boosters to new ingenuity. As dealers prepared their kids to return to school in August, shoplifters fanned out armed with long order lists of clothes and kids' sizes and shoes, shirts and pants, and school supplies. One kid I talked to wheeled flat-screen TVs through a Walmart tire shop, which rarely had much supervision, and had a door with no alarm. Line a purse with aluminum foil, and the sensors of any merchandise you put in it wouldn't activate the alarms as you exited Walmart. Thuma drove other boosters to Walmart, who'd go in the store and find a large box containing a child's outdoor plastic slide. They wheeled it to a secluded area of the store and emptied it. They would then tour the store, filling the now empty box with DVD players, Xbox consoles, headphones, Tide detergent pods. They would pay the $20 that the slide cost and wheel the box to the exit. When the alarm invariably went off, they would show the elderly greeter the receipt and be waved out. Some electronic malfunction, no doubt, honey. Another veteran Walmart booster told me he would wear very baggy clothing, with long john underwear underneath, taped at the ankles. He'd walk through the store stuffing merchandise in his long johns, which would balloon out, though nothing would show under his baggy pants and shirt. I walked out of there, It looked like I was 400 pounds, he said. People in Portsmouth opened stores in their apartments, specializing in certain products, most of which they stole from Walmart, garden supplies, tools, automotive equipment. One recovering addict told me he visited the apartment of a woman who stocked everything a baby needed. She had a bedroom you could go into set up like a store, diapers in one corner, baby food and formula, clothes on a dresser like a display table, he said. Then she'd have boxes of high chairs and strollers. She would go into Walmart to steal shit, or she'd have people go in there with orders, and they'd deliver it to her. Walmart, for a long time, did not require a receipt for returned goods. Anything stolen could be returned for a gift card for the full value of the merchandise. Dealers bought those cards for half their value in pills. A $500 Walmart card was worth three OxyContin 80s, for which the dealer had paid a few dollars with the Medicaid card scam. A vast trade in Walmart cards kept Portsmouth's army of pill dealers in household necessities. A Walmart receipt, meanwhile, could get you cash. Junkies scoured Walmart parking lots for discarded receipts. They'd steal the items on a receipt, flashing the paper at the greeter as they left. Then they'd return the merchandise with the receipt and exchange it for cash. Amid this madness, the sons and daughters of Portsmouth's business owners, the children of sheriff's captains and doctors and lawyers, saw a future in OxyContin. Some regarded pills as a grassroots response to economic catastrophe, the way some poor Mexican villagers view drug trafficking. Dealers who could not have found a legitimate job in moribund Portsmouth bartered pills to support themselves and feed their kids. Some remodeled dilapidated houses. Others bought cars or trucks. When 6 months ago, there were kids going to school with shoes falling off their feet, and now they have new shoes, we feel that's an accomplishment, Marianne said. Our parents had all this opportunity. Portsmouth was a booming town then, with a bus system and trolley and jobs that lasted. We were raised with a sense of pride for our town. But when we get out into the real world, there's nothing to be proud of. We can't help our town. So when we found a way to help our town, we did. Which in turn backfired on everyone, of course. Down in Jalisco, Nayarit, black tar heroin lifted sugarcane farmers to the status of local merchants. In Portsmouth, middle-class pill addicts made choices that plunged them into the underclass. They ended their education with high school. They had kids too young and weren't married when they did. Before long, they were pocked and penniless on the street. But as a generation of kids wasted away in post-industrial Portsmouth, their parents were unable to not give them gas money to get some new job that never existed. They couldn't bring themselves to not pay their bail or electric bill. When some of these kids died, mortified parents told neighbors that their son had a heart attack or their daughter had died from injuries sustained in a car accident. It took a full decade before a Portsmouth mother was able to reject pretense and be the first in the state to say publicly that dope killed her son. A Criminal Case, Southern Virginia. In August 2001, about the time Jamie Maya was discovering how many injured Washington workers were dying from painkiller overdoses, and reports of widespread OxyContin abuse were circulating through Appalachia, John Brownlee took the job of U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Virginia. The office is a small one, with only 24 attorneys, but it was located near the gathering opiate storm. Brownlee had a sterling Republican Party pedigree. His father had once been Secretary of the Army. Brownlee was in the Army Reserve and continued to perform his reservist service while U.S. Attorney. He was being mentioned as a possible future governor of Virginia or a state attorney general. Years later, after all that transpired, when Brownlee was in private practice and those possibilities were no longer being discussed, I spoke with him at some length by telephone. During his years as U.S. Attorney, he said, people were dying of overdoses across the states of Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Southern Virginia. Other prosecutors' offices were indicting notorious pill mill doctors, David Proctor among them. Brownlee's office jumped into the fray with the controversial prosecution of a Roanoke doctor named Cecil Knox, whose state records showed was a prolific prescriber of OxyContin. From there, Brownlee said, he decided to take a broader view of what was going on. We looked at this and said we should take a look at the company marketing this stuff, he said. He subpoenaed all Purdue's records relating to marketing OxyContin. The records numbered in the millions of pages and emails. Federal employees took up residence in a conference room on a floor of Purdue headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, and copied company files for months. Brownlee said the record showed how the company was training people to sell OxyContin as if it were non-addictive and did not provoke withdrawal symptoms. Physicians, therefore, could feel comfortable prescribing it for many kinds of pain. One of the pieces of evidence that was looked at were call notes. The company had a process in which salesmen would go to a doctor, then summarize what was discussed. That went back to a central clearinghouse. Once we were able to see those, we began to see a pattern of conduct. Is this a few rogue guys, or is this more of a corporate policy? It became clear that this was more than a few rogue salesmen. They were trained to sell the drug in a way that was simply not accurate. That was some of the best evidence of misbranding. It was an extremely high percentage of sales reps in various states who were making these allegations. This was done in all 50 states. That's when you rise to corporate culpability. By the fall of 2006, John Brownlee was prepared to make a case of criminal misbranding against Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. Took over the OxyContin belt, Columbus, Ohio. Forget you have children. This advice was given to Mario, an illegal immigrant, by his new boss from Jalisco, Nayarit. Mario was preparing for what turned out to be a short career as a dispatcher for a black tar heroin cell in Columbus, Ohio, a few years after the man brought the drug there. Forget that people may do to your kids what you're doing to the children of others, his new boss told him in a restaurant one day. Otherwise, you won't sleep. And, he added, don't let the clients die. Care for them. They're giving you money. Mario had worked for several years as a mechanic in Portland, Oregon. Many of his clients then were heroin runners in Portland from Jalisco, Nayarit, or villages nearby. He sold them two or three cars a week. They offered him work in their networks, which he declined at first. Then a series of financial problems made him reconsider. So one summer he accepted a job with the Jalisco man he called his boss, and they drove to Columbus. I spoke some English. I was clean. I had ID. Good credit to rent an apartment. I rented one there. They paid the rent, he told me. He earned $500 a week as a dispatcher, taking telephone orders from a roster of users. The network sales grew to more than $2,000 a day. His boss returned to Nayarit and waited for workers like Mario to send the money home. Mario woke in his bare apartment each morning, took phone calls all day, directed the drivers but rarely socialized with them. He hated needles, but he lived far from the effects of what he was selling. I never saw anyone inject himself, he said. I never saw people get sick from lack of dope. I knew how people got sick. I never knew anything of the people who died. Had I known, I'd have left it. The drugs arrived regularly from Nayarit. It did not come in truckloads as he imagined it would, like on those television shows. Rather, it came with couriers carrying a kilo or two at a time. Ant-like, he thought. His boss shipped it from Nayarit to Pomona, California, where it was cut up and sent in smaller quantities to Columbus and other cities. The boss hired workers from Jalisco whose families he knew, so he knew the network would send its profits back to him every month. His boss himself had once worked as a runner in another network before going out on his own. He knew all the dealers and drivers in Columbus. Mario made trips with his boss to Nashville and Charlotte to arrange supply deals with other networks. He dispatched drivers around Columbus for 4 months, until the day the police barged in, and he went to prison. Nayarit doesn't have a cartel, he said. It's people acting as individuals who are doing it on their own, micro-entrepreneurs. They're always looking for where there's more money, places where there's no competition. There are thousands of small networks. Anyone can be boss of a network. Because of that, the Jalisco boys had succeeded by the mid-2000s in avoiding virtually every town Americans traditionally associate with heroin. No Jalisco boy ventured to Baltimore or Philadelphia or Detroit. No Nayarit sugarcane farm boy was going to shoot it out with armed heroin gangs in New York City. They didn't have to. Mid-size metro areas had legions of new young customers, and no worrisome gangs or mafias. The Jalisco boys' ranchero farm boy roots and unbeatable retail system had led them to areas of least resistance, now tenderized to heroin by the widespread prescribing of legal opiate painkillers. They went, said one cop I met, and took over the OxyContin belt in America. The Jalisco boys, in fact, were hardly the country's only heroin dealers. Detroit, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York had drug gangs who'd controlled the trade for years. Nor were the boys the only Mexicans trafficking in black tar heroin. Northern California was controlled by traffickers from the Tierra Caliente, a humid and notoriously violent part of west-central Mexico. No Jalisco boy ever stepped foot in Northern California. Sinaloans controlled the Chicago and Atlanta markets, both of which were major distribution hubs. The boys for sure weren't going there. Yet all these gangs were known for their violence and gunplay. To me, that made them almost passé, like Wild West gunslingers. None of them controlled the drug from its production in Mexico to its sale by the tenth of a gram on streets across the United States. The Jalisco boys did. They were dope traffickers for a new age when marketing is king and even people are brands. Purdue branded OxyContin as the convenient solution to disruptive chronic pain patients. The Jalisco boys branded their system the safe and reliable delivery of balloons containing heroin of standardized weight and potency. The addict's convenient everyday solution, the one to start with and stay with. Like Purdue, but quite unlike traditional heroin dealers, the Jalisco boys didn't sit around waiting for customers to come to them. They targeted new ones using come-ons, price breaks. They followed up sales to good clients with phone calls that amounted to customer satisfaction surveys. Was the dope good? Was the driver polite? Drivers would travel across town to sell a $15 balloon. Addicts learned to play one crew off another. The other guy was giving me 7 balloons for $100, you're only giving me 6. The effect was to keep the addict not only using, but drumming up more customers to get bigger discounts. Meanwhile, Jalisco dealers were constantly monitoring good customers for signs that any of them were trying to quit. Those addicts got a phone call, then a driver plying them with free dope. One Albuquerque addict told me this story. He called his Jalisco dealer, whom he considered his friend, to say he was going into rehab. Good idea, the dealer said. This stuff's killing you. An hour later, the dealer was at the addict's door with free heroin. Now that you're quitting, the dealer said, here's a going away present as a way of saying thanks for your business. The addict kept using. A woman in Columbus told me her dealer welcomed her home from jail with a care package of several balloons of tar heroin to get her using again. The more astute among the Jalisco traffickers realized they had owed much of their success to prescription opiates. A few had heard of OxyContin. Most of the Jalisco boys I interviewed, though, had not. They were oblivious. They knew nothing of the history of heroin in America. They didn't know how their customers came to the drug, that they were now selling to a historically new clientele, customers no one expected to be using the drug. Why would they? They spoke no English, and holed up in Spartan apartments when they weren't driving, and thus had little feel for the United States. They weren't sociologists. Most weren't about to converse with the addicts about how they got into dope. To them, the less FaceTime with addicts, the better. They were quick-hit artists. They were selling well and didn't care why. But their delivery system and cold-blooded marketing combined with an enormous and growing clientele newly addicted to pills, were the reasons for their success. By the 2000s, these ranchero farm boys, from a county of just 45,000 people, in a state most Americans couldn't find on a map, had become the most prolific single confederation of heroin traffickers in the United States, aggressively seeking new markets while supplying dope in at least 17 states, including unexpected places where heroin was all but unknown, before they showed up. The final convenience. Charlotte, North Carolina. Few parts of the United States benefited more from the economic expansion that began in the mid-1990s than Charlotte, North Carolina. Its metro area, which includes part of northern South Carolina, grew fastest of any metro region between 2000 and 2010. Nations Bank of Charlotte acquired Bank of America in 1998, and the city became B of A headquarters. New York retirees, in turn, flooded the town, and Charlotte learned what a bagel was. Six other Fortune 500 companies appeared, as did NBA and NFL franchises, and a silver skyline. Charlotte's metro area includes almost 50 golf and country clubs. The town's southern end absorbed the better-off newcomers, who transformed it from cow pastures to a sprawl of McMansions and shopping malls in less than a generation. Latino immigrants came for the jobs, too. Attracted to the state by agriculture and pork slaughterhouse work, they filled in fading North Carolina rural towns, then moved to the more stable work in Charlotte. The city's Latino population grew faster than any in the country. Prescription pill use rose in Charlotte just as it did across the country with the pain revolution. In time, that meant more opiate addicts. For years, heroin in Charlotte was powder brought in from New York, uniformly weak and sold solely by young black men on a few streets off Statesville Avenue in the north part of town. Their clientele was limited to the modest number of addicts in the metro area. The Statesville area was where, in the early 1990s, Brent Fushi got his training as a young narcotics officer. In his younger days, Brent Fushi spent 2 summers selling Bibles in Mississippi and the coal mining regions of eastern Kentucky. It was, he thought later, the kind of work that stunted one's growth as a human being. He was awful at it. As he sold the new King James Version, he endured occasional lectures from Pentecostals who favored the original King James and believed the new version to be heresy. In Pikeville, in a mining region of Kentucky, a place Fushi came to regard as the end of the world, he lived in a trailer park. His neighbor was the owner of a coal mine who was hiding out because his workers had gone on strike, and he was running the mine with non-union labor. Yet Fushi came to believe that it was there, selling the Bible, where his training as a narcotics officer began. A natural introvert, he had to force himself to knock on the doors of people he didn't know and keep talking. Years later, he joined the Charlotte Police Department. Early on, his narcotics sergeant ordered him to make a heroin buy on a street near Statesville Avenue. Fushi had 3 weeks earlier been there on patrol, in uniform. "They're going to know I'm a cop," he said. "No, don't worry, just do it," said the sergeant. "You'll be all right." So that afternoon, in plain clothes, his hair now longer and unkempt, Fushi walked onto the street. Whistles and hoots sounded the alarm. 5-0, 5-0, the dealers called, the street code for cop. Fushi approached the dealer, doing his best to look strung out. "I need something, man," he said. "You're a cop, dude," the young dealer said. "No, man, I ain't a cop. I'm sick. I need something." "You a cop, motherfucker." "No, no, I ain't." "Who that, then?" The dealer pointed into some woods 50 yards away, and to Fushi's partner, a large man trying to hide behind a sapling. "Dude, that's my fucking brother. He's watching me to make sure I don't use his shit after I buy it. Man, you're going to sell me this or not?" Sure enough, the dealer sold him the smack. "Keep talking," Fushi learned, like a salesman. "If you're talking, you're still alive." Talk was the undercover cop's great gift, and Fushi came to rely on it in times of stress. The kid wasn't stupid, Fushi thought later. He was just begging to be persuaded, letting greed control his better judgment. Street dealers made money on each sale and thus wanted to be convinced. Talk long enough, desperately enough, and you could usually get them to sell to you. Talking and convincing people, using his wits, were what selling Bibles trained him to do. But Fouché also noticed that very little of what he learned selling Bibles and buying dope applied once the Jalisco boys arrived in Charlotte. Within years of the man's first visit to Charlotte, the Jalisco boys were crawling all over the town. Fouché watched as heroin got cheaper, more potent, more available. The market for the Statesville dope got real thin. Unlike the dealers near Statesville Avenue, these Mexican guys drove cars. Even if you did speak Spanish, which Fouché did not, you couldn't talk with them, because the deal took place in a matter of seconds, and they were gone. Before the Jalisco boys, department policy forbade an undercover cop from getting into a dealer's car alone. But the Jalisco boys never sold outside their car. So one day, Fouché called the number and was told to park at a shopping center. Soon, a small red four-door car passed with a Mexican at the wheel. The driver raised an eyebrow. Fouché pulled out after him. He followed the red car into a residential neighborhood and through several streets until it pulled over. Fouché radioed his location to his backup and walked over to the driver's window. The guy's car was immaculate. In the heroin world, most cars Fouché had seen were strewn with festering food, crumpled cigarette packs, and grimy clothes. But here was an older car, a heroin delivery vehicle, without a speck of trash. He handed $60 to the driver, who spit three balloons into his hand, gave them to Fouché, and drove off. Fouché stood in the street and watched him go, saliva-covered balloons in his hand, feeling witness to a revolution. He later wrote a thesis on the Jalisco system for a master's degree in criminal justice. In time, the Jalisco boy drivers proved easy to bust, but the cells were all but impossible to eradicate. Prison sentences that North Carolina imposed for heroin trafficking of 7 to 20 years barely affected them. This especially bothered Sheena Gatehouse, who became chief of the drug unit at the Mecklenburg County District Attorney's Office as the Jalisco system spread. Gatehouse had joined the prosecutor's office just out of law school. She spent her first years prosecuting misdemeanors and small drug cases, usually marijuana. She left to become a defense attorney and handled the first of the region's OxyContin abuse cases, her clients being the children of doctors. In 2009, she returned to the prosecutor's office. Black tar heroin dominated the caseload. The Jalisco boys were relentless. And what made them so was that the workers, the drivers, were disposable. The bosses didn't seem to care how many got arrested. They always sent more. Addicts were overdosing and dying around Charlotte. Gatehouse's office instituted a new rule: no easy deals on heroin cases. 20-year sentences grew common. Yet this didn't affect the Jalisco system or the prevalence of their heroin. The price kept dropping. Balloons containing a tenth of a gram started at $5 for $100, then went to $10 for $100. Finally, by 2011, you could buy 15 balloons of potent Jalisco black tar heroin for $100, $6.50 a dose, about the price of a pack of Marlboros. In Charlotte, North Carolina, a town that barely knew the drug a few years before. One bust in 2012 made her question the approach. Cops spent months buying from Jalisco drivers. The investigation involved a dozen officers. Finally, they busted the drivers and a dispatcher. They also took down some addicts, seizing their cell phones. 3 days later, those confiscated phones started ringing. Jalisco dealers were calling. The store was back in business, they said, with new drivers up from Mexico. Officers hadn't even finished processing the evidence from the bust, and the store was running again. The drivers were not career thugs, as far as Gatehouse could tell. They were farm boys hoping for a better day through black tar. Sheena Gatehouse went back and forth on the wisdom of the tough approach. The damage they did clearly required it. But, she said, We're sending a farm boy away for 20 years and have had no impact. More kids back home clamored for the chance to replace those just arrested. What's more, each bus seemed to provide an opening for more crews, so that one busted crew was replaced not just by one, but sometimes by two. With competition, addicts had more numbers they could call, and Jalisco customer service kept improving. At the Carolinas Medical Center, Bob Martin saw the change as well. Martin, a former New York cop, came to Charlotte in 1996 for a job as director of substance abuse services at CMC. During his first years, when he heard of a big heroin bust, he threw up his hands. His beds were certain to fill with junkies checking in to ride out the drought. But by the early 2000s, whenever police corralled a dozen Jalisco heroin dealers, Martin saw no new flood of addicts rushing to his beds. There was no drought. The bust didn't affect the area's supply of heroin. "No matter how many million-dollar busts you guys do," he told the officers, "it doesn't show up on our radar." Martin also noticed an entirely new kind of junkie. Half of CMC's patients addicted to opiates now had private health insurance. Martin studied the zip codes where they lived and found that they came from the town's wealthiest neighborhoods, Raintree, Quail Hollow, Mint Hill, in South Charlotte that had once been cow fields. These areas were also home to 9 country clubs and the region's best shopping malls. It was as if these guys from Jalisco had done market research to discover new heroin markets. This thought also occurred to a Charlotte undercover police officer who went by the name of Jaime. He had been working narcotics at the Charlotte Police Department since 2007, black tar heroin mostly, buying from Jalisco dealers hundreds of times. Jaime believed that the Jalisco boys looked for towns where kids had cell phones, money, and cars, and where a lot of people were addicted to prescription painkillers. At first, he saw they were almost sadistic the way they talked down to desperate junkies, leaving them waiting, and insulting them when they finally showed up. But in 2009, that changed. After Jaime bought from them, crew bosses called to ask, "Was the service good? Was the runner rude?" Once, a crew boss called to apologize for a late driver. He had a lot of customers, he said, and he was going to get on his people to be more prompt. After another buy, Jaime's phone rang. "We've heard from others that that batch wasn't as good," the guy said in halting English. "What did you think? If it was bad, I want to tell the guys we got it from that we don't want that stuff anymore." Jaime had no choice but to go along. "Yeah, man, it was crap, really bad. We'll make it up to you." At the next buy, his dealer gave him an extra balloon and apologies. Jaime attributed the new attitude to competition among the Jalisco crews in Charlotte. Other higher-ups in Jalisco, he figured, were imposing the quality control of a Fortune 500 company. Their service was better, he noted, than many legitimate retailers. Meanwhile, though supplies of heroin were unrelenting and addicts were everywhere, Jaime saw no outrage in Charlotte. He spoke to the parents of one junkie after another. As soon as he said the word heroin, their minds crashed to a halt. They couldn't conceive of their children on heroin. For every symptom, the parents had an answer. "Do they see burned aluminum foil around the house? We thought he was burning incense. Was he slurring his speech? He was getting over the flu. Were his grades failing? He was going through a phase." Jaime spoke to the city's drug-free coalition, which was focused on alcohol and marijuana. "No," he told them, "heroin is the real problem." He and Gatehouse spoke to a group of headmasters from Charlotte's best private schools, hoping it would ignite a local crusade. It didn't. Despite spreading addiction, no parent in Charlotte, of the dozens he spoke to, came forward to warn school groups, churches, the media. Heroin touched the families of doctors, ministers, bank executives, and lawyers, but they retreated from it, crushed by grief and the drug's stigma. How a son died with a spike in his arm was not what you talked about at the country club. A half dozen reporters asked Jaime for contacts with parents who had lost children. He would plead with the parents to come forward and tell their stories, to help keep the next kid from dying. None did. A conspiracy of silence enveloped Charlotte. Heroin seeped through the city and suburbs in South Carolina with only a few cops, prosecutors, and public health officials battling it. Jaime, meanwhile, grew philosophical. Opium was a trade good that